You're on the Plants Grow Here podcast. I'm Daniel Fuller. Come along with me as we enter a hidden world of deep horticultural, ecological, and landscape gardening knowledge with featured experts, industry professionals, and enthusiasts.
You didn't really think that ecology is just for hippie greenies, did you? Ecological services can save big bucks and big headaches with regards to pest control, water management, erosion, urban cooling, and so much more. Dr. Ian Smith, friend of the show and entomologist slash ecologist, is back to basically sum up half of the wisdom that's been dropped on the Plants Grow Here podcast over the last 170 episodes. He's giving a talk at the Australian Institute of Horticulture's conference next month titled Planning Green to End Up in the Black, Incorporating Environmental Services into Horticulture, which he's not going to spoil in our interview. Wait, before we go on, you are attending the conference, right? It's going to be 3 days of pure horticultural love between the 26th and the 28th of October. There will be three full-on days of learning and networking, including botanic gardens tours, technical workshops, and an award ceremony. I'll be receiving an award for this podcast, so it'd be great if you could attend and show some love, and maybe even share a beer or a coffee with Ian and I. Check the show notes to learn more. Welcome back to the show, Ian.
Glad to be a serial guest, or pest, whichever you prefer.
We'll go with guest for today, but let's talk about pests as well.
Ah, yes, good point.
I'd like to start with a pretty open-ended question. I mean, can you tell me what is an ecosystem service?
So an ecosystem in its broader sense is anything that the natural environment provides us that provides a benefit to humans. And that's often economic, but it doesn't have to be. It can be human welfare, mental welfare. So it's just at its scale, it's basically what horticulture is. How do we use vegetation to benefit humans?
Right. So I guess ecosystem being the science of, you know, organisms and their surroundings.
Yeah, that's correct. And we usually think of it as undisturbed ecosystems like rainforests and forests, but urban ecosystems is still a thing. It's highly modified, but it's, you know, if you go out your front door, you will see birds. And that's just all part of that ecosystem.
Right. Okay. So how is an ecosystem relevant to horticulture? You said it basically is horticulture. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so horticulture serves a purpose that it's using trees to manipulate our surroundings in some way. The most obvious is aesthetics. We like to have homes that have nice gardens. We like to have that little oasis. And when you talk about wealthier suburbs, you talk about the green leafy suburbs. And so. By trying people asking for those services, that's an aesthetic service. So that's what horticulture is trying to deliver. And that's one aspect. But it's not necessarily the only aspect that horticulture can provide. And that's my personal field of study. I like to look at how vegetation can provide other ecosystem services.
Okay. So aesthetic, in terms of like ecology, I guess that's because we are a part of nature. You know, we tend to think of ourselves as outside of nature, but that's not really the case.
Yeah, and we not many gardens have one type of plant. Maybe you can think of a few
some
gardens.
Do. Some do.
But, you know, humans like to have multiple plants in the garden usually. And there's actually a concept called evolutionary psychology whereby we humans evolved in a certain ecosystem and we are still we still have a preference for that sort of environment. So we like an environment that looks like it can provide a lot of food, but also provides a bit of shelter, but not too much shelter that we wouldn't be able to see predators coming. So that usually lends itself to a sort of woodland type structure. So we like a garden with tall trees, with some undergrowth, but not too much. And I guess that's like an English cottage garden, really.
Yeah, that's the sort of garden that I like. So you've got trees, you've got shrubs,
And then you've got like a ground cover, and maybe you've also got some climbers, as long as they're not getting too scrappy. I mean, I like a bit of scrappiness, but I like the climbers to be climbing up a pole or a fence or something like that. Not necessarily up the tree, but that's just my personal preference. But yeah, I think even if you don't understand what you're looking at, I think most people would look at a garden that has those different layers, has some sort of diversity there. You know, some plants that are in flower, not necessarily all of them, although that can look nice too. But it's like an intuitive thing, isn't it?
Yeah, we know what we like, but we don't necessarily know why, or it's not something we really think about. You just look at a garden and go, I like this garden, and you look at another garden and like, I don't like this garden. And, you know, there's multiple reasons for that, and there's everything from your upbringing to innate psychology evolution. So,
So I guess every choice that we make in a garden is going to have some kind of ecological effect. So we're planting alyssum in the garden, that's going to attract predatory insects. It's going to decrease our pest populations, or we take them out and then the pest populations increase. Or, you know, we put in more trees if we can. I was actually talking about this with Mark Lawrence recently about a climate change episode, sort of talking about how climate change is a lot more than just atmospheric carbon. Mm. So he's making the point that if you've got enough trees, they're going to transpire, one of those two words. They're going to release water out of the leaves. And what that's going to do is it's actually going to increase rainfall in the area, whereas if you take out those trees, well, then we're going to get less rainfall. So every choice that we make with plants has a consequence on the overall environment.
Yeah, and if you can actually feel that effect. If you go into a particularly leafy garden on a hot day, so I know my parents-in-law, they have a acre block, and they've got most of it is open paddock, and I was walking around in that paddock. It was absolutely stifling. But then they've also got this little patch of it's really dense with partly cherry plums, but a bunch of other plants. And as soon as you walked in, it just felt like someone had turned the air conditioning on. And that's right. That evaporative cooling taking place. So the infrared energy from the sun hits the leaf. It warms up the leaf, but then the moisture comes out of the leaf and it dissipates that heat. And cools the surrounding air. And now that water is in the air, it also cools the surrounding area as well. So that's why the more vegetation you have in the area, it's just the cooler it feels. So if you've ever laid on a lawn that's like very low cut, it just feels like you're laying on the ground. But if you lay in like really thick grass, like it's on a summer day, like it feels really cool. And that's one of the effects that's happening.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that's what we're talking about when we talk about the urban heat island effect. It's literally that.
Yeah. So if you take, a thermometer, if you have a series of friends and you stand in a line across a city and you all hold a thermometer out in front of you, you can actually see the temperature increase as it reaches towards the CBD, because the area of greenery gets less and less, and you actually see that temperature start spiking by quite. It's I think it's I can't remember the exact, but it's several degrees, and that actually has a big impact, because the amount of energy to cool a house by just 1 degree is fairly significant. So if you to go back to ecosystem services, if you want to cool an area down, just having trees that can reduce the temperature by just 1 degree, that's a lot of energy savings. And consequently, that's less energy people have to pay, which consequently means more money back into the local economy.
Now I want to move on to, okay, so what are some of the key ecosystem services that are around?
Yeah, so there's just so many, but probably the most commonly discussed is, as you alluded to before, beneficial insects and pest control. So the more diversity you have in the garden, the more different insects, particularly generalist predators, can survive there, and the less you may have to use insecticides, for example. You can actually see this in effect if you hit. I've spoken to a vineyard owner before, and he used just very light insecticide only when required. His neighboring property used really heavy-handed methods, and then once that by the end of the season, the one that went heavy-handed actually had more pest problems because he'd knocked out the ecosystem service of all the beneficial insects that was living in the other crop. That's an ecosystem provided by diverse plants and pollen, etc. But then there's other aspects that we are less commonly spoken about, such as water and flood mitigation. Trees intercept water raining down from the sky, so not all of it will actually reach the ground. Mm-hmm. Consequently, an organic matter dropped onto the ground will act like a sponge. It slows that water down. If you've ever seen a creek that's full of vegetation versus a concrete drain, the water in the concrete drain is just moving way faster, and it can cause way more damage. So slower water, the best way to mitigate a flood is you want basically the landscape to act like a big sponge and release that water slowly over time rather than it funneling into one section.
So here's that term again. So I'd really like to start bringing this more into the podcast, and it's SUDS. So that's sensitive urban... What's the D in the S? I can never remember what it's
design services, design systems.
Sensitive urban could be. But essentially what it's talking about is rain gardens. So it's like it's really just capturing that water and putting it in the soil rather than letting it wash out to sea. And there are a few reasons why we might want to do that. One is that it stops those petrochemicals from getting out into the ocean where we really don't want it. Like, these plants can actually do somewhat of an all right job of breaking down some of this stuff and making it less harmful. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, who doesn't love plants? Like, let's get some plants in the city and use that water as a resource instead of seeing it as a waste product.
Yeah, if you look at biodiversity of our creeks as they project, as they reach urban areas, once they get into the areas where stormwater flows straight into a creek without stopping, it actually drops off really rapidly. There's a few reasons for that, but one of them is that when you get rain, you get this massive influx of fresh water that completely throws out the chemical balance of those waterways. So only really tolerant species can survive in a lot of the circumstances. So, That's one of the reasons why, you see those car slowing structures on the road, but they've also act as rain gardens as well. Mm-hmm. And also it's a good idea if you can slow that water down into a garden. Well, it's less irrigation you have to worry about.
Yep, that's it. And I just want to touch on what you said there about you've got to choose the right plants. It's not just about their ability to tolerate those salts and those chemicals as well. It's also that they have to be able to withstand extended dry periods and then extended wet periods. So not all plants can do that. So we've got stuff like lamandras, and a lot of those strappy plants are well known to be able to do that. But also I've been working with Osbreed lately, and shout out to Osbreed because they actually have done a great job of breeding some of these plants they're able to. They've actually got callistemons, and a whole range of plants that you wouldn't think would be good in swales, but now, you know, it's more than just lamandras. So, yeah, shout out to Osbreed.
Yeah, my personal favourite is Knobby Club Rush, just because when I was a poor uni student and wanted to grow it, I just went into the local car park at the supermarket, grabbed a handful of the seed and threw it on soil, and it grew quite well. So.
Well, that actually brings up another point, is that cannot be great in some ways because we actually don't want to be encouraging seeds to be washing into the waterways unless it's like literally something that's endemic to the area. But most of the plants, like native is a really low resolution term. Like, what are we talking about when we say native? It's like we're planting kangaroo paws in Melbourne and even some of them up in Brisbane. Shout out to Osbreed again. Not many kangaroo paws can thrive in Brisbane, but the mega golden nichozanthos can. But Yeah, we've got to be careful not to spread weeds around. So stuff that has low seed virility is really good, even though there's a trade-off there to be made with biodiversity.
Hmm. Well, knobby club rush is actually indigenous to Melbourne, so no issue there. But you're absolutely right. Like, the distance between Western Australia and Melbourne to call something native, well, that's like calling something from Spain planted in Russia native, basically. Like
exactly the same. Yeah, it's a big bloody country, mate.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was one of the driving why we planted blue gums everywhere. It was this drive for native plants. It's really not the best plant to plant out of its region. But I'll leave that one to the foresters to debate.
Well, we all live and we learn, don't we? So another thing is as well, like you might go out to the bush and take some seeds and you plant them in your garden. Oh, great, they started sprouting. The urban environment is a very different one to the local indigenous environment, just because like we put completely different pressures on plants.
Yeah, there's Themita grass is one of those.
Right.
It's a bit of an ongoing debate, like, because it's if there's a bit of drive to sort of get those grasslands back because they've been so cleared. There's very few pockets of them left. So they want to preserve the genetic diversity around, but at the same time, there's also this question of, well, should we actually just be growing what's the most vigorous? Because there's so much. So, I mean, I don't think there's a right answer here, and I think it just depends on the circumstance. So, you know, if an area is just, you know, and, you know, it's previously been car park, well, I'd just go for the most vigorous strain.
Right.
But if you're developing an area that's right next to, you know, national park, then yeah, preserving the genetics is probably a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about this with the head gardener Russell Lark and also a horticulturist Marie Veldhoven from Cranbourne Gardens, and they were saying that they'd love to be able to plant some of the native peas. What's the bloody thing called? Hardenbergias. No. So they'd love to be able to plant some of the Hardenbergias over there, but because they have a little native one in there, if they put it there, what's going to happen is that some of that pollen from the cultivated one will end up in the native plants and then really mess up the population.
Yes. So you really need to have that sensitive design when you're dealing next to, like, you know, remnant vegetation. Like you don't want to be releasing anything that's going to spread too easily into the ecosystem there.
But that's not to say not to have a crack, guys. Just don't let all this stuff stop you. Okay, you should still be gardening and experimenting, and just do your best.
Yeah, I mean, that most people don't live next to pristine environments. They've all been affected to some degree. So usually if you're in an urban area or an agricultural area, it's, you know, something's better than nothing a lot of the time.
Right. Yeah. And also another thing is, shout out to Osbreed yet again, plants that are selected for seeds, so stuff that you grow by seed, generally tend to be more like seedy and more weedy, whereas stuff that's like tissue culture and bred by cloning, that tends to be safer in terms of weeds as well. These are just generalities, but if you think about it, it makes sense. Like if I'm trying to grow a plant to look beautiful, I'm really not caring about its seeds as much because, yes, there's a part where I'm really trying to crossbreed, but then I'm really trying to take the genetics of that plant and keep cloning it and keep cloning it and keep cloning it. Whereas if I'm trying to sell seeds, well, what am I really selecting for here? It's the seeds, isn't it? It's the virility of the seeds, because everyone wants that seed to strike as soon as you plant it.
Yeah, and it's almost a self-selecting thing, really. If you're trying to harvest seed, well, you're going to end up with the most seed collecting plant, and I guess that's something you have to be careful with. Is that actually the best outcome? So if something is good at producing seed but is, you know, terrible at resisting pests,
yeah, absolutely. So, okay, so, you know, we've talked about some of these ecosystem services, but we've really only scratched the surface, haven't we?
Yeah, so, we've touched on aesthetic and property values. It's remarkable how much property values can increase just by the surrounding areas. You only have to go to Toorak and how people describe the large trees there. There's improved soil quality. The microorganisms and macroorganisms in the soil, they just basically support entire human civilization. Without them, we wouldn't exist. Noise reduction is actually one that's not often thought about, is just the shape of trees and the all the leaves actually deflect noise, and they to some degree they can reduce noise by sort of quite a few decibels, in some instances 10 decibels, but if you it's probably cumulative over a landscape. Yeah, you can think of if you've ever been camping in a forest that, you know, it's quite quiet, well, except for the trees rustling, of course, but but probably the one of the most notable at the moment is temperature regulation. We touched on urban island heat effects, but that's probably probably quite pressing now. I think the Bureau of Meteorology has just declared that it's an El Nino, so we're going to be facing some hotter, drier conditions going forward.
Mm-hmm. So we got that to look forward to. Another El Nino. Yeah, everyone loves a good El Nino.
Yes, make sure your irrigation systems are in check and ready. And ready.
Yeah, well, we'll see what lives, hey? We'll probably...
Well, I have said I'm a bit of an ecological gardener, which means whatever lives, lives, and whatever dies, dies. Yeah, it just wasn't suited to the environment.
Yes. And that's great in the urban landscape. You know, we can test what's going to live, and it's not so great in the natural landscape.
No, and there have been some sort of disturbing ideas, I guess you could say, that, you know, maybe if we're revegetating, maybe we shouldn't be revegetating to what is currently native, but what the future climate trends might suggest. So maybe moving from a woodland species to maybe moving from a forest species to a woodland species that's a bit more fire tolerant. That's another ecosystem service, is because trees slow down wind speeds, they can in some instances actually slow down fires. They can also exacerbate fires though, so that's always a complicated topic to discuss.
Yes. Oh, not like horticulture, but the rest of horticulture is rather simple. But just in terms of, you know, resilience against drought, well, again, we can talk about the ecosystem services brought by soil quality.
Yeah, so the more organic matter you have in the soil, the better it resists drought. And maybe not by that name, but every horticulturist worth their salt knows to use mulch if they want to preserve moisture. And that's just what that is. It's adding... adding organic matter to the soil, which adds micropores, which allows water to soak into the soil a lot quicker and reside there a lot longer. And then you, as a happy coincidence, you're promoting all these beneficial insects that, like worms, invertebrates, should I say, like worms, which live in that organic matter and spread it through the soil, which makes little micro channels, which allows the water to penetrate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And, all around good stuff to drought-proof your garden to some degree.
Not only just that too, and to literally shield the soil from the rays of the sun, like it actually provides a buffer.
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to compacted soil and put your hand on it on a 30 degree day, it's uncomfortable, warm, and basically very little can actually live in those sort of temperatures. Mm. Whereas if you go put your hand under some mulch, you can feel it's actually nice and cool there, even on the hottest days.
Particularly if the mulch has been there for a few years. You know, mulch is not a quick fix, but this is a time thing. Another thing I wanted to point out as well is be careful of really fine mulch, because it can actually become quite hydrophobic or even just stop that moisture from getting into the soil. So I like to use a nice thick mulch a lot of the time. It's got those big gaps, big pores that the water can travel down, big pathways, rather than getting stuck on the top levels. Because if you'll notice, a lot of the time the mulch that we use, it's great after a big downpour, everyone's happy, smells like rain, and then you walk outside and you brush across the mulch and underneath the first mill or two of mulch, it's completely dry.
Yeah, so I think that's partly caused by it's the carbon-nitrogen ratio, which is you'd probably know it by your worm farm or compost bin, is you don't want all browns and you don't want all greens. So I personally like to mulch with leaf mulch. So it's still got that green in it. It's still got that. And that means it breaks down a lot quicker. With like pea mulch or straw mulch, it's still got that high nitrogen content in it. So it breaks down into the soil a lot quicker. Whereas a lot of mulch, if it's really fine, woody matter, it's high in carbon, not necessarily very high in nitrogen, which means if you've got very active bioactive soils, it's probably fine. But if you put a thick layer on it, you can get that sort of you run into situations where not a lot's utilizing it, which means, you start getting that buildup of hydrophobic conditions.
Okay. So what we've been talking about, ecosystem services, it really is just horticulture, as we've been saying.
As a scientist, I like to just put complicated names on simple topics.
This is like the best of Plants Grow Here episode. We're basically just going right through the whole catalogue. So this is really something that we have control over. It's not like a passive thing. It's not like, nature, let nature take care of it. These are really choices.
Yeah, so it's passive in the sense that they're going to occur, but it's also active in that we can manipulate it. If we decide we want a garden with a lot of sun and to say grow vegetables, that's a choice. That's great. At the same time, a lot more sun means a lot more evaporation. It's choosing what ecosystems do you want to prioritize. I to think of an example, if you were contracted to build a garden for, say, a nursing home, the client might be saying, I just want it to look good, but you might also want to think about, well, what other services do I want here? And you're thinking, well, heat stress and cold stress, so you want something that can block the wind in winter, you want something that can provide shade in summer. I think ecosystem services to horticulture is just a new, it's not a tool, it's a lens in which to view a problem and to talk to the client and realize and ask them, you know, what is it beyond the garden that you want to achieve here?
Yeah, and how long do you want it to look good? Like, do you want it to look good this afternoon after I leave, or you know, are we trying
just
to
buy some flowers, stick them in the ground.
Put them in the ground? And we've all had clients like that, let's face it. But or do we want to build something that lasts? So if we want to build something that lasts, shut up and listen to me for a second, please.
I might suggest some other wording, but yeah.
this is the thing. Clients, a lot of the time, if you just you have to give them what they want, but you have to see beyond their words to understand what they really want, and then you have to figure out how to communicate to them that you're going to do what they want without just it's not about doing everything they said. You know, my wife's a graphic designer, and she used to get all the time clients would be like, oh, just do whatever you think is in your head, and then she'd give it to them, and then they'd be like, no, that's not what I imagined. You know, I imagined something different. And it's a bit like that with clients in horticulture, because they say that they want this and then you leave and it dies or it doesn't look great in 6 months' time or 12 months' time or whatever. Well, then they're not going to be happy with you anyway. So it's you got to think in tree time, as they say.
Yeah, it's looking for not what the client is asking for, it's what they want. And so it's, they say, yeah, can you put in all this row of conifers there? And it's not saying, yeah, we can do that. It's saying, what is it about conifers that you like?
Right.
And if they're saying, oh, I just want something that stays green all year round, it's just like, well, you know, it doesn't have to be conifers then. There's other options. And so, yeah, it's a bit of a trick of conversation and negotiation, really.
Yeah, and have you heard of cypress canker?
Yeah, because that's another point to bring up. Maybe they're researchers and they want cypress canker. You know, that's another conversation.
Maybe they do, yeah. But, yeah, that's really true about as a horticulturist or as a landscaper or even as a nursery salesperson in retail. Yeah, you gotta know the right questions to ask. You've got to see beyond what the words are of the client, and you've got to see to what they actually want, because that builds trust. Yeah, and you don't tell them to shut up.
Yeah. No, the trick is open questions. Is just like, really, why is that? And it forces them to start talking, and then you can start ascertaining what they really want. Mm. Whereas it's a closed question, like, I can get you this, or
I think this is better.
Yeah. And they're like, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this person over here said that they can give me cypress.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there any specific plants or like design principles that we can use to like maximize the benefits? Like, are there any cheap hacks that you can tell us about in terms of, you know, these ecosystem services? Because it is quite complex, isn't it?
It's complicated and it's simple. Right. It's like there's all these interactions in nature and ecosystems, but ultimately you just need to note down what your priorities are. And it's going to be simple when you know what your priorities are.
Mm.
If you know it's heat abatement is your biggest thing, is it aesthetics, is it biodiversity, If you decide on any of them, then the answer is going to be quite obvious. So, you know, if it's biodiversity, you're going to want to look at diversity of plants to drive diversity of insects, to drive diversity of birds.
Yeah, diversity is great. I think that there's a few things I want to say about biodiversity. So I see people fetishize these, in inverted commas, native plants. It's like, do you think that the local native bee really knows the difference between, you know, an exotic and a native plant? Like, is it really making that decision? Like, sure, there are some specialized relationships. Can't deny that. But, like, do you think that we've gone too far with this idea of, like, oh, natives are good, exotics are bad?
Yeah, so it's a scale and it's nuance. So if you look at, to use two examples. There's been studies in California and Australia where we've looked at pure native garden beds and their effect on beneficial insects and pest control. And we found that a diversity of native plants is the best because you've got all those native insects that have co-evolved with the native plants.
Right.
But conversely, when you've got highly modified landscapes, that's not necessarily the case. So if you've got, say, highly sodic soils, which is means that they, when water runs over them, they erode very easily. So it's an interaction, but I won't bore you with the chemistry, but yeah, it's part of it. So you get these channels. Now, you can try planting natives there, but because the area is so disturbed, they haven't evolved in that sort of environment. So you probably want a more aggressive plant, and that can be from anywhere just to stabilize the area. If you've got an area where it's causing erosion, you probably want to go to start of that erosion and put in a plant that's just going to use up as much water in the groundwater as possible to actually slow the groundwater from causing that erosion, which I would suggest getting a consultant if you've got major erosion problems. But, it's all about the problem that you're facing or the opportunity that you're trying to achieve. So, Yeah, in some circumstance, absolutely, you want to go 100% native plants. In other circumstances, well, not necessarily.
Right. I think as well we fetishize certain biodiversity. So it's like, yeah, we all want the bees and the blue-tongued lizards and the green tree frogs, but forget about the ants. Forget about the, you know, the forget about the non-venomous snakes. It's like we don't want them in the garden.
Yeah, I think the term thrown around is charismatic megafauna. Mm. We love the koala, but if you want to throw out there an endangered slug, people are going to look at you funny.
That's right. Yeah. So that's a human thing in terms of like, oh, we like these things. They're charismatic. They're cute. Now, that's actually a really good segue into bees because there's something very interesting happening with honeybees in Australia right now.
Yeah, so it looks like the government has moved from eradication of the introduced varroa mite, and now they're going to control. So that means they've, through discussions and maths, I don't know the exact process that they go through, they've decided that it's no longer feasible to eradicate it. So it's now down to learning to live with it. It's a bit early days to decide what that's going to look like. If it's anything so like the phylloxera in grapevines, that means setting up zonage. Zonage as to where different things can be moved in and out of, or whether they can be moved in and out of. So that's something to be on the lookout. So varroa mites, for those who aren't aware, it's a small, flat, red-looking mite, and it lives in beehives and on bees. It connects to their abdomens and slowly drinks the just drinks it like a smoothie, I guess. Drinks the bees, just siphoning their energy out. In the short term, it doesn't really affect them. But as time goes on, over, say, about 3 years, the mites get more and more numerous, and the hives gets weaker and weaker as it starts sort of hemorrhaging this extra energy, and eventually the hive just can't sustain itself, and the death of that specific colony.
Can be quite horrific too. So there's I've seen some of the footage of it, I think, or it's like there's a heat involved and slumpage of the colony itself. It's just, it's quite horrific.
Yeah, the beehives are, it's almost like a living being because there's all these different parts. And when one starts breaking down, when you've got less workers, you've got less energy, which means when you've got less energy, you've got less egg laying. So it's all interconnected. It's really complicated system, really.
Yeah, not pretty, not nice. So what does that mean for Australian horticulture? Like, is that going to have consequences in amenity horticulture, in fruit production? What's it going to mean in Australia?
So in the short term, you won't notice much just because it is a new introduction, and it's going to take a while to establish and start actually having an effect. In the long term, bees can be managed to control varroa. It's going to put costs up a little bit. What that actually looks like, probably too early to say, but the rest of the world already manage it. So it's not going to be catastrophic for managed apiarists and beekeeping. So it's going to be a bit more paperwork, going to be for like moving bees around the state. It's going to be a bit more money in possibly using control chemicals. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but we do have some level of knowledge of how to manage it from overseas, which is was lucky for us to be the last to be infected by this mite. So we've learned from what everyone else did and what happened to them. For amenity horticulture, in the short term, probably not a lot. Long term, you're probably going to stop seeing so many bees that come from feral sources because in a sense, it'll probably start acting like a biological control agent.
Yeah. I'm wondering if it's a good thing for the native landscape because, yeah, as much as we love bees, honeybees rather, European honeybees, they can be a pest.
So, yeah, this is a bit of a question mark that research is needed in. Bees do take up hollows and nesting boxes that could be used by other species, particularly native species. Bees are quite aggressive in their collection of nectar. If that nectar is available, then someone else is going to take up the slack, and that could be native pollinators. So what the effect is going to be complicated, and yeah. I don't want to be too specific with my estimates, but I'd say what the current role that feral bees are taking is probably going to be taken over by back over by native species. When you think of pollinators, we tend to think of the introduced honeybee, but there's a whole plethora of pollinators, and that includes flies. Flies are one of the bigger pollinator groups.
Yeah.
There's not native sexy. Bee. Not a sexy, no.
Neither are mosquitoes.
There have been attempts to pollinate pollinate in hot tropical areas where bees don't do well with blowflies by using offal, which try selling that one. I don't think Capilano is going to go for that for their branding. It's going to be very interesting, and I guarantee you there's going to be more than one researcher seeing how this shift plays out.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, so we'll keep our eyes on it over the next few years. So going back now to ecosystem services that like we can perform in our own gardens. So someone else is taking care of the bees. That's happening behind the scenes. That's probably for another episode. I guess if we're trying to provide habitat, so whether that's for amenity, like we just want to see the sugar gliders, we need to understand what we're trying to attract, or maybe we can just go for a generalist option and provide, as you say, lots of biodiverse plantings. We're trying to get habitat, so stuff like fairy wrens will like small, sharp, dense, shrubby things, like dense plantings of, you know, Lamandra hystrix, which has those really spiky flower spikes. We can do some, what's the acacia that's really spiky? Do you know that one?
Paradoxa.
Paradoxa, yeah. Love it or hate it.
Hedge wattle.
Yeah. Yep.
councils like it when people are graffitiing fences. They just put a row of that.
No, it's not one you put underneath the playground for softball, though.
No. I don't, well, how, do you like kids? Or, yeah. No. native indigo, I think, is... I think it looks like box thorn, but it's a native. So,
right. So, yeah, they're going to – lots of little hardy places where they can hide from those bigger birds. We all love rainbow lorikeets. They don't really need any more help. They're fine. They're one of the winners of the urban landscape. Let's think about the little fairy wrens and the little brown ones, stuff that the non-sexy fauna. I mean, they are sexy too, aren't they?
Yeah, it puts me in mind of native grass, use of native grasses and grasslands. So people generally don't think about it, or they're not interested. And then when someone gives them a walkthrough and shows them like the interactions of an intact grassland, they're like, I didn't know this was so fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think that's the same with like amenity horticulture is you can. If you don't know what you want to attract, just put in as many possible habitats as you possibly can fit in the space. If you're just going to go all out for biodiversity, that's putting in rock shelves for reptiles. Lots of organic matter, long grass, a lot of when it comes to bird diversity, there's every strata level of the vegetation is taken up by different birds, basically. So some prefer the very top of the canopy, some prefer hanging to the side of the tree tree stem, and then there's some that like to forage on the ground and some that, yeah, like to be in small shrublands. So trying to get all those different strata levels in vegetation.
Mm-hmm. Leaving the dead wood in if you're going all out for biodiversity.
You can
get a professional arborist who knows how to do this. Do not do this at home, by the way. But you can actually put tree hollows into established trees. Not something I'd recommend anyone listening to do this unless you actually really understand about a tree's biology and how to use a chainsaw. Because there's a little thing called the kickback zone, and that's not fun.
I just stand on my folding chair while I swing it around.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. If you can swing it around too, that'd be great.
Yeah.
No, just for legal purposes, not advocating anyone to use a chainsaw because that's
please get
really
a chainsaw
dumb.
Certificate before carrying forward.
Yeah, and also it's the tree biology too, so you can create weaknesses in trees if you don't know what you're doing. I know that there are some people who are really into this. From what I've seen, and I'm really speaking out of turn here, it's about leaving a bit of a limb and then carving a hole into that limb stub so you're not going too deep into the tree itself. But again, this is not a recommendation that I would say for you to do.
Yeah, there is some if you look up some – there's some foresters out there who can actually provide some advice. Foresters or arborists, there are those who actually specialize in sort of that native revegetation and will actually know methods to do it most efficiently. And I think the biggest risk is if infection gets into the plant, if you do it poorly, well, you've just wiped out half your tree or structurally weakened it.
And create falling limb risks and all sorts. So,
absolutely.
Stay away from trees is what I always tell anyone, any of the maintenance gardeners I've ever worked with, just stay away from them.
Yeah, I think what I said arborists aren't necessarily cheap, but losing your neighbor's house is even more expensive.
Yeah, and if you're found to be liable, that's not fun.
No, not at all.
Also, healthy plants. So like you said before, like you can put in a native thing into the wrong soil type and you can sit there and you can blow on it and you can wish and pray all you want. Just put something that's going to last there and it's something that's a little bit happier. I mean, everything just about has some sort of a relationship with something else. I mean, not all flowers are highly pollinated. Like you might get the prettiest looking flower. It may not be the most pollen rich. It may be selected for aesthetic beauty. But at some state, at least in the soil, it's doing something, encouraging grubs to grow that feed this and then that feeds that. And then it's quite complex and just doing something is better than doing nothing.
Yeah. And sometimes we don't even notice it. So grasses produce actually a fair amount of floral resources for insects, and they notice it. And there's another group that notices it. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them. That's hay fever sufferers.
Yes.
So one of the biggest producers of that is ryegrass, at least in the Melbourne district. I mean, someone's getting a meal out of it as much as...
Yeah, there's no pollen in grasses. There's no nectar in grasses. So people think that they're not good for pollinators, but... Yeah, it's so much more complex than what you'd think.
Yeah, I might have to check that. I think
they're wind pollinated.
A little bit of nectar. Oh, yeah.
They're stereotypically wind pollinated, so people think that means that they provide no resources. Well, particularly perennial grasses have a pretty serious root system as well that's doing some pretty good stuff. Like we had a Pennisetum, an Osbreed. I was just doing a presentation to landscape architects recently. One of the Pennisetums that we have... low seed producing, so it's safe near waterways and stuff, and it's something like 400 and don't quote me on this 400 and something 475% I believe soil strengthening just from the roots. So pretty crazy.
Perennial grasses, you're right, grasses don't produce nectar. Annual species, Their goal is to get up quickly, drop seed, and before winter hits, pretty much. Whereas perennials, they can take their time, so they're not worried about the season, so they can get their roots right down there, and tap into that deeper moisture, bring the nutrients and moisture up, and start improving the soil. So, yeah, it's the just that structure of that root, that network of roots, just provides so many benefits. And yeah, a lot of the degradation in the Australian landscape was early on was just because the European settlers, a lot of them who were farming weren't actually farmers. They were just the ones who ended up here. Right. And so they just, I think it's like the first fleet. I don't think there was any farmers with them, or there was hardly any anyway.
Genius.
bit of an oversight. I'd double check that one, but I'm pretty sure that's the case. They just went all hell for leather with profit, and they just kept grazing. And then suddenly the perennial grasses weren't really around anymore, and only these annuals, which could eke out from this heavy grazing. And then we introduced rabbits, and yeah, so you're just wiping out. Once you wiped out, that's just caused havoc in the ecosystems.
Yeah, not good. I remember when I was doing my diploma, so I did it remotely, and talking with people, I did it through an agricultural college, and some of these farmers, it was really heart-wrenching. They were literally in tears, like big, tough guys, and they're trying to talk through, trying not to cry when they're talking about their farms that, you know, their dad handed down to them, their dad's dad handed it down to him, and it's just multiple generations back, and they've been farming the same thing over and over and over again. And then it's like now for the first time they're hearing about stuff like cover crops and stubble and stuff like that. And it's like, you got a long road to go before you're going to get it back to the way it was before.
Yeah, there's so much more research, and we know how to do things a lot better now that it's just a matter of, you know, getting the crops at the right time, using the right sowing methods, using the right stocking rate. You know, it's starting to turn around slowly, and it's just a matter of getting that knowledge transfer and getting the economic systems and incentives right. It's not a situation that's going to be changed on the weekend, but you know, I think we understand better landscape, and now we've got all this, you know, equipment and agrochemicals now that the opportunities is a lot more available than it was in the past. You know, trying to control a hectare of weeds with hand tools was never going to happen.
No. And I think city dwellers are quick to judge as well, to pass judgment on farmers. They're actually quite clever. If you actually listen to a lot of farmers, like particularly people like Farmer Renee on Twitter, Lisette Mill is a natural resource manager who works in agriculture. She's always having good conversations. Just some of these people on Twitter, or X as it's now called. Farmer Renee, just search her. She's great. I saw a diagram she posted. This was a while ago now, but she does cotton, and there's this moth that is a well-known pest for cotton. And what they'll do is they'll leave some sacrificial cotton crops so that they can spray some of the crop when they need to, when populations build up too big. It's not evil to spray, okay, people? But then they'd leave like a certain percentage of the crop unsprayed, and that was sacrificial. So what would happen was that the genetics of the moths that were eating those crops and the ones that were sprayed would keep mixing, so that the moths never built up a big enough tolerance to that spray.
Yeah, and that's the same concept with rotation of insecticide. Is each insecticide has a little letter on the front of what type they are. If you don't know what they are, I would suggest getting your A cup for chemical use. It's well worth learning what those all mean. But the idea is each different letter affects insects in a different way. So if you rotate through them, they never evolve to like resistance to all of them, because you'd need to have a super insect that has managed to survive each of the genetics has survived each of those sprays. One of those traditional ways of just leaving the sacrificial is just, you know, that's a great way to do it, keeping the genetics in there. So, so if it's done correctly, it sounds good to me.
Can you tell me about any challenges or like trade-offs when prioritizing ecosystem services, particularly in the amenity landscape?
Yeah, I think, I mean, of course it depends on your priorities, but it may require challenging traditional assumptions. Is a good lawn one that's beautifully manicured and gives that crisp architectural division of zones in a garden? Mm. Or is a good lawn one that's a bit longer and diverse that absorbs infrared radiation, keeping the area cool and provides pollen resources for beneficial insects? There's not really a right answer there. It's just depending on what you're trying to achieve. So, you know, if you're trying to sell the latter, then, you know, for someone who expects a good garden is, you know, got 90 degrees angles on it, then, you know, you might have to, you might be challenging that. But a lot of the times, prioritizing ecosystems can just be done in a way that, you know, people aren't going to even notice. Planting trees on the western, big bushy trees on the western side to catch the afternoon sun to keep the garden cooler, you know, that's, no one's going to question that. It's not really challenging an assumption. Mm. It's just, you know, it's just a design choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are some of the other challenges or trade-offs?
Yeah, there's the challenges is understanding what you're trying to achieve, and that may require further research. So if you had a situation where someone wanted to encourage biodiversity, then you might have to look at what the native species in the area and what they actually require. If they say they love native wrens but they hate pigeons, then you're going to have to look at, well, what is needed to encourage one but not the other. So you might need to do a little bit of background research into the biology of different species.
How do we get rid of noisy miners? Can you tell me that?
I think I'm going to have to talk off the cuff here. I'm pretty sure they do well in urban areas because they can lay their eggs and create their nests in urban structures, and they prefer them over native species. So I think it's about looking where they're nesting and, you know, putting up that mesh to prevent them from nesting there. Other than that, get a pet hawk, I guess.
Because, I mean, like, we'll take the rainbow lorikeets, you know, we'll take the cockatoos, okay? Have at the bark, it's fine. Like, but, yeah, the noisy miners, I just have a general dislike for them because they're just not good friends. They're just argumentative and they just bicker. I mean, the rainbow lorikeets bicker too, but at least they're colourful. No. The noisy miners, they're just so mean. They're just bullies.
Sorry, I've just realised I've just answered a question about common miners, not noisy miners. Oh, so,
okay, yeah. See, the common miner is a brown one, right? That's the non-native one. See, the noisy miners, you'd think that we want them because they're native, but they're just so mean to everything.
Yeah, so the way to actually control them, I actually know that one, is they do well in edge habitats. So they don't do well if you've got an area of forest. You won't see them as commonly in the center areas where it's not as disturbed, but you will see them in the edges. So in an urban environment, not a lot you can do because the urban environment is all pretty much, yeah, it's their domain.
Yeah, wow.
So if you happen to be lucky enough to live in a sort of a rural living sort of block that backs onto a national park, then make sure that you can try and keep those edge areas, even extend those edge areas into your property, and just give that bit more of protection to the intact environment behind it.
I see. So it's about creating habitat for other things, not necessarily about reducing habitat for them.
Whenever you're trying to reduce or increase a species, the first thing to do, and it's amazing how often this doesn't happen, is just to sit down and actually read their biology and their behavior. So you see this all the time with rabbit control, is people will go jump straight to the way to control them is by shooting them. But if you do the maths on it, it generally doesn't actually make sense, because for every rabbit you see above ground, there's more underground. Mm. So, and the rate they breed, it's the number of knights and shooters you'll need to control them that way is just the maths doesn't add up. Mm-hmm.
It's like cane toads too up here in Queensland where I am now.
Yes. So with rabbits, it's if you read up their biology, they generally can't survive without cover because they're so prone to heat, cold, and predators that the best way to control a rabbit is to get rid of their warrens. If you can get rid of their warrens, you'll get rid of the majority of rabbits.
Because they're not easy to dig. That's a lot of hard work.
Yeah. You try digging into the soil with your claws. It's all very energy intensive, and while they do it, they're prone because they can't look behind them for foxes and cats.
Very cute though.
It does look cute. Just keep them caged up in your backyard. No, I meant pets. I mean, it's
no, that's illegal.
I mean, look after your pets is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Well, what have I suggested? I'm going to have RSPCA after.
Okay, so can you give us any examples of somebody, particularly a city? I think we're about to talk about Melbourne here. Like, what are Melbourne doing right in this respect?
So I only know the basics of it. Maybe you can talk to the Melbourne City Hall cautious at a future episode. There's an idea. But so I know that Melbourne has an urban forest strategy, and that's pretty much all looking at ecosystem services. It's crunching. This isn't some hippie greeny movement. This is hard data, financial crunching, and realizing the importance of trees in city areas. And there's some real dollar figures on this. So I know they're looking to increase tree cover by 10% across the whole city. And I think they've estimated that can save annual heating and cooling costs per dwelling by $50 to $90.
Wow.
So, you know, just something that small that only 10% of the area can have that level of economic value is pretty astounding.
And it doesn't sound like a lot, by the way. $100 a year is not a lot of money for one person. But when you add that up, suddenly now we're talking.
Yeah. I mean, if I went up to a house and said, I'll give you $90 a year if you put a tree over there, like I'm sure most people would do it.
Well, no, it would cost a lot more to put the tree up, wouldn't it? For most trees.
Ooh, you're the horticulturist.
It would. So the answer is yes, it would. Depending on how small you're growing it. I mean, if you want to buy tube stock, sure, you save money if you want to do it yourself, but it's going to take a long time. What do they say? It's something like 30 years for a tree to become carbon neutral, which is an insane statistic.
I haven't heard that one. That's,
isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Plant more trees and then 30% of them die.
Yeah, you got to look at how you're growing things.
Yeah. You've got to establish trees, not plant them.
Yes, I wouldn't say not planting trees is a carbon offset, but
no, it's not either. Yeah, just not doing it isn't the answer. But the answer isn't to plant the tree, get the votes, everybody claps, and then you leave and the tree dies. That's not the answer. We want to establish the tree.
Oh, I've seen that way too often. As you said, when you times $50 per dwelling across an entire city, like you just think, you know, that's not a lot of effort for a fair amount of outcome. And, you know, how long do trees live for?
Yeah. And when we talk about going back to property prices again, it's a wise investment. Like there's a reason why Toorak prices are so big. It's partly because of those trees out the front. The plane trees, which are beautiful. Oh, my goodness, the bark on them. They're very huggable trees, those plane trees.
Yeah, it's I remember there was a big push in the western suburbs for a while. There's a lot of pushback because everyone in the western suburbs,
right.
You know, it was
a cheaper area.
It was a cheaper area, and it was grassland originally. It was grazed. It was originally grassland, and it was originally all farmland. Mm. And it's because it's new estate, there hasn't been much time for trees to establish. And there was this suddenly this big backlash. It's like, well, why can't we have tree-lined streets? And whether it was part of, but whether it was because of that push or whether it was forward think by the council, it's starting to turn around now, and you see a lot more trees in those western suburbs now. And just people like trees.
I believe Jason Summers was a big part of that. He was tree manager at one of the councils around there. But yeah, he was. Listen to the episode with Jason Summers. That he very enlightening, and he's done. He's actually made it. He's one of those. You know, everyone tries to make an impact. He's a person who's really made an impact on Melbourne, particularly in the western suburbs.
Mm, yeah, and that's the best thing about working with trees is like your legacy is going to go on lot longer than you.
Yeah, particularly if we're establishing them, like he was focusing on.
Yes, it's establishing the trees, not planting them. another aspect that I know Melbourne was focusing on was that sort of sponge interception of trees on rainfall, because it's projected that Melbourne's going to have a lot more flash flooding events. By getting more trees in, you reduce the severity of that, and that's both through intercepting it in canopy. It's also absorbing it through the roots. The cost to without it to overhaul the guttering and drainage and storm watering is just astronomical. Wow. It's just not feasible. Mm-hmm. So trees is a fantastic non-engineering solution.
Mm. Yeah, bioswales, all this good stuff.
Mm-hmm. And it looks nice.
And it's an investment. It's helps with climate change. Yeah, if we're talking about it takes 30 years to capture that carbon, that's a very myopic way to look at it. It's really, I think, the wrong way to look at it. There's a lot more environmental good that comes from trees than just carbon capture. It's one of the aspects. It's great.
Hmm. I mean, if you want a really boring episode, I can just sit here listing off all the benefits of trees. Yeah. But
No, that is actually a good idea for an episode. We'll just get you just reading off the list in a monotone. Yeah.
I will raise one that's often not thought about, though, is mental health benefits. This one is actually being measured and tested, and there's been psychological studies where they've put people in hospitals in rooms that have overlooked vegetation, mm-hmm. and those who, I guess, overlook just concrete. Mm. And there seems to be a statistical significant result that people with that view of nature feel better sooner. And we also know that people who go for regular walk in forested areas or vegetated areas, they feel less stressed. And that's actually been tested, like testing the cortisol in the blood, that people who are in areas of vegetation actually feel calmer.
I don't need some scientists to tell me that, though.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much my field of study, is just to work out very complicated things to what everyone already knows.
It's like, trees make you feel good. Go figure.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but now I can prove it.
Okay, so I've just got two more questions for you, Ian.
Yeah, sure.
What are some of the emerging trends or innovations in the amenity horticulture industry related to, like, ecosystems and the power of ecology?
So I think it's partly being driven by necessity with climate change, unfortunately, is, what worked in the past may not be working in the future. So there's a bit of this drive to rethink how we look at urban spaces and how we vegetate urban spaces. But it's also driven, though, by community awareness. So, you know, issues like global insect decline, that's really captured the public's imagination, the loss of pollinators. So people are starting to demand that sort of thing. Like, they don't want just a concrete garden with a single lemon tree. They actually want to, you know, see that they're contributing to the solution and not contributing to a problem.
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, if Mifkus was onto the bees this year, the general masses can't be too far behind, because people were talking about bees decades ago, and I think where the listeners of this show are probably a little bit ahead of that.
Yeah, yeah. It's and it's always a bit tricky when you work in the field day in, day out. You're just like, I'm not actually sure where the general public are on this this situation. And so, like, so it's always a bit of a issue going out there and talking and just like, am I too far ahead of the curve here, or am I being condescending?
Yeah. It's actually funny, because there was this, it was in Europe somewhere, but it was this hotel, and they just introduced like tens and tens and tens, or hundreds of thousands of bees, I think, or tens of thousands of bee colonies, some number of bee colonies. It just boggles the mind. And it's like they really disrupted the local ecosystem. And just so they had the best of intentions, and they just threw everything completely out of whack.
Yeah, as they say, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Yeah, so true, so true.
Yeah, that's yes, the cane toad is also a nice.
Yes, an integrated pest management. Yeah, we love IPM.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, a little fun fact about the cane toad is the CSIRO actually Australia's, I think, possibly retired chief entomologist actually recommended not introducing it, and it was agreed not to introduce it. Oh. But it was unfortunately later overruled by pressure from
well-meaning do-gooders.
Yeah.
Virtue signalers who aren't in the field. So, Ian, look, usually at the end of every episode, I ask people what else do they want the listeners to know about, but I want to tell you what you want the listeners to know about this time. Tell us about your tell us about your AIH talk in Cairns in just a few weeks.
So I'll be delivering a talk at the at the conference. Looking forward to it. So I'll be having a partly elaborating on what we've been discussing, but also looking at pretty much every aspect of vegetation that's not the vegetation. So yeah. Everything from how to maximize biological control and how I think I gave the name of my talk is how to end up in the black by being green. It's Yeah, looking at how vegetation and ecosystem services and all that can be used to actually promote the bottom line, because they're not really separate in the end. It's if it were separate, horticulture and agriculture wouldn't exist. it's just about looking at that hidden world beneath what we can see and how it interacts, and how you can use that as a tool for horticulture in general.
Mm-hmm. I like that. How to end up in the black by being green. Like you say, we have one word for that, which is sustainability. It's just so we can keep doing it over and over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, it seems obvious, but we often, it slips people mind. It's, you've got deadlines, you've got demands.
And aphids are on the tree today.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't often sit down and go, well, was this a design issue that those aphids are there? Mm. And if you tell that to a client, they're going to give you a funny look. But but maybe that's, as I said, that's a tool. Maybe you can offer that as a value add service. It's like, yeah, I can build you this garden, but have you considered, a pest resistant garden?
Yeah, because pest resistant garden is an easier sell to a certain kind of a client than an ecological garden.
Yeah, absolutely. And in reality, they're much the same. Mm. A healthy ecosystem is a balanced ecosystem, is a good for human ecosystem.
Well said, mate. I'll see you in Cairns. Cheers.
Yeah, see you there.
Planning green to end up in the black is going to be an incredible presentation. I'll also be giving a talk on building a green workforce. Ian and I would love it if you came and said g'day. Events like this have personally made a huge difference in my own career, and I try to attend as many as I can based off the advice of my mentor, Karen Smith. Don't be a stranger and do some networking while you're there. You never know where your next career opportunity can come from. I'm getting to the point in my own career where I'll be needing a network of up-and-coming Aussie horticulturists who are capable of creating content to help me out.
If you aren't able to attend the Cairns event, that's a shame, but maybe I'll get to meet you on LinkedIn or at a future event.